Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NATO-led forces are in danger of losing the war in Afghanistan. That's the conclusion of the U.S. military right now, and it's prompting General David McKiernan, the top NATO commander there, to make a rare public appeal for help.
We certainly need more military forces here, but I'll be the first to tell you that additional military forces by themselves will not guarantee victory for the Afghan people.
Already this year, more coalition troops have been killed in Afghanistan than all of last year. On the campaign trail, both candidates are promising a renewed focus on Afghanistan. Here's Barack Obama.
We're going to have to put some additional troops in Afghanistan. General McKiernan, the commander in Afghanistan right now, is desperate for more help.
And John McCain's pushing for an Iraq-style surge strategy for Afghanistan.
General Petraeus has just taken over a position of responsibility where he has the command and will really set the tone for the strategy and tactics that are using. I've had conversations with him. It is the same overall strategy.
This hour on Point, Afghanistan in crisis. In a moment, we'll hear from journalist Robert Kaplan, who says the U.S. needs to look at Afghanistan from a regional perspective. But first, we go to Kabul, where Christian Science Monitor correspondent Anand Gopal is on the line. Anand, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Anand, can you give us a sense of how safe it is for you to travel throughout the country now? How far out of Kabul can you actually go?
It's gotten extremely dangerous to travel either within the country, within the city of Kabul, or outside of it. In fact, just yesterday, a Canadian journalist was kidnapped from Kabul. And I have traveled outside. In fact, last week I went just a 30-minute drive outside of Kabul. And when you leave Kabul to the south, the areas are completely controlled by the Taliban. There's almost no government presence whatsoever. And most foreign NGOs have sort of pulled back all their operations from the provincial areas and are focused in the main cities now. So it's gotten really dangerous. The security situation has gotten much worse this year.
Extraordinary. And do ordinary Afghans that you speak to feel secure?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Do ordinary Afghans that you speak to, do they feel secure?
Yeah, certainly there's a real sense amongst ordinary Afghans that the security situation has really deteriorated. This is actually one of the reasons why people are turning towards the Taliban, because there's criminal bands that roam the streets of Kabul and outside the highways everywhere. A lot of Afghans get kidnapped and held for ransom, and a lot of people feel that they can't travel safely from one place to another.
And is there a sense, an overall sense, that you're seeing with the people you speak with there, that the situation has gotten much, much worse over the past several months?
Yes, there's a real sense that the situation's gotten a lot worse. Whereas a couple of years ago, Afghans often talked about, you know, having hope for the future, a lot of them now are really wondering what the future is going to bring. Like I mentioned, people don't want to send their children out in certain areas anymore, whereas a couple of years ago they would have. People don't travel roads that just last year they would have. So there's a real sense that things have gotten much more dangerous. Hmm.
In my experiences in Afghanistan, I found that many Afghans actually like to have the international military presence there. I'm wondering now, with the spike in civilian casualties this year, at least a third as a result of NATO-led airstrikes, is the Afghan public becoming more hostile toward the NATO presence there?
Certainly, the level of anti-Americanism and anti-Western feelings is probably at an all-time high this year. It's not just civilian casualties, but there's also a feeling amongst a lot of Afghans that the international forces have been here for 7 years and we haven't seen security and we haven't seen a tremendous amount of progress in the Afghans' view. So there is a growing disillusionment with the international forces.
And Gopal, what about the government there? The U.S., as you know, has long pushed for this very strong democratic central government under the leadership of President Hamid Karzai. How do Afghans view the government now? Do they regard it as legitimate?
The Afghan government support is also probably at an all-time low. There was actually a recent U.S. intelligence estimate that said that the Qajar government only controls about 30% of the country. And I think that was given in the spring. That's probably even a bit optimistic now. Like I mentioned, I went outside of Kabul last week, and I couldn't find a single person that claimed to support the central government. You know, people feel that Hamid Karzai has had 7 years to change the situation, make things better, and he hasn't delivered. So there's really the support for the Qajar government is an all-time low as well.
In a sense that it's rampant with corruption, yeah?
I'm sorry?
In a sense that corruption is rampant as well.
Yeah, that's right. Corruption is rampant. You have to really bribe your way to do anything here. For me to getting a simple visa, I have to pay bribes. And for Afghans to go to any government office, they have to be willing to grease the pumps to make anything happen. So people are really frustrated with the level of corruption. There's been a lot of cases even of Afghans who criminals who've been arrested and then bribed their way out of jail even.
Mm-hmm. One final question for you, Anand. The Taliban seem to be making inroads with Afghans. In other words, are they, in a sense, doing a better job at winning over the population than NATO troops?
In some ways, they are. I mean, they've set up a parallel government in a lot of the areas they control, and they have these Sharia law courts, and they dispense justice. And they're often brutal, but they're also less corrupt than the Afghan government, at least. And people have associated the Afghan government with the international forces. And so as people get disillusioned with both sides, they turn towards the Taliban.
Hmm. Anand, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
And stay safe there, please. Anand Gopal is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from Kabul. Joining me now to get the latest on the Washington side of the equation is Peter Spiegel, Pentagon correspondent for the LA Times and a colleague of mine. Peter, good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Guy.
Peter, walk us through the Pentagon's thinking on Afghanistan at the moment. What's happening behind closed doors there?
Well, we have multiple reviews of Afghan policy going on from the White House, from the National Security Council, and within the Pentagon itself. Now, frankly, I tend to believe that the Pentagon's review is going to have the most weight because being led by Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and obviously no matter who becomes president in 2 or 3 months, Mullen will still be around. He'll still be chairman. So his views on how Afghan policy should change are going to hold a lot of weight. Obviously, David Petraeus has moved now from Iraq to where he is going to oversee both Iraq and Afghan policy, so he's going to weigh in here as well. But Mullen's review is been underway for about a month now, and there's a real debate going on within the Pentagon about what to do, whether particularly over troop levels. And this really sort of mirrors the debate that went on before the surge in Iraq, where some argue that in order to do the traditional, you know, clear the area out of insurgents, you know, hold the area for an extended period of time and then build on it, it's a very manpower-intensive project, and you need a lot more troops to do that. On the other hand, there's a real sensitivity of appearing as an occupying force, and there's back of everyone's brains is the Soviet experience where they outstayed their welcome, needless to say, and a lot of the tactics that the Westerners have contemplated, from poppy eradication to some of their heavy-handed civilian casualties that you mentioned earlier, Guy, a lot of those are beginning to resemble the Soviet experience of the 70s and 80s, and that's a real concern among some commanders here in both on the ground in Afghanistan and here in Washington. So that's into the mix as well.
That's interesting. Peter, this morning I was reading an article about General David McKiernan's press conference that he held in Kabul yesterday. When General McKiernan arrived to Afghanistan to become the NATO commander, he was asked if NATO forces are winning, and he said no. He didn't say they were losing, but he said they weren't winning. It seems now there's a different kind of message coming out from commanders like McKiernan yesterday, trying to put a better face on the situation in Afghanistan. What are the people at the Pentagon, the military officials at the Pentagon, what are they saying about Afghanistan? Do they think it's in danger of slipping?
And actually, they haven't. This is conversations you have both behind closed doors, but frankly, also in public. I mean, again, to focus on Admiral Mullen, because for the last year, he's been the guy who's really trying to refocus the Pentagon's thinking from Iraq to Afghanistan.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He on Capitol Hill just a couple of weeks ago said he does not believe we're winning in Afghanistan. He said we think we will eventually win, but right now we're not winning. And not only that, he said recently that he believes next year is going to be tougher than this year, and it is just a matter of inability to free up troops because of the large presence of particularly army units in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and they will not be able to find additional troops to move to Afghanistan. So there's a real, I wouldn't say it's a sense of panic, but there's a realization that things have gotten, 2008's been a really bad year for the alliance, and that 2009, without a huge increase in troop levels, is going to be even worse.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, the various reviews that are taking place at the Pentagon, among the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and at the White House. This all sounds very similar to the fall-winter of 2006, when the White House and the Pentagon and the Office of the Secretary of Defense started to look and revise their Iraq policy. Is that essentially what's happening now, Peter?
It is, but everyone you talk to emphasizes that, you know, Afghanistan is not Iraq, and for a number of reasons. First of all, the terrain. I mean, Iraq is a very flat place where population centers are largely centered around the Tigris and Euphrates river valleys, which makes the classic counterinsurgency, send in a lot of troops, get out amongst people, very easy. The area, particularly in the west and the south, I'm sorry, the east and the south, which border the Pakistani border regions, which is where a lot of these insurgents are finding refuge and crossing across the border. This is incredibly mountainous areas. These are tough places to there's not a whole lot of urban areas. There's a lot of small towns and villages. It's very tough terrain. So the same kind of just send a lot of troops and flood the zone kind of strategy that worked in Iraq may not work in some of these regions. So there's a lot more talk of trying to find special forces to do these kinds of work. Again, where do you find these troops? So it's a much more complicated problem that they're dealing with in Afghanistan.
Peter, please stand by. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back to you in a moment. And we'll also hear from journalist Robert Kaplan. LA Times Pentagon correspondent Peter Spiegel is on the line with us from Washington. Peter, I want to play a brief clip of tape here. Earlier this month, Sarah Palin, the vice presidential Republican vice presidential nominee, claimed at a rally in Florida that Barack Obama was mischaracterizing the role of U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
He said, too, that our troops in Afghanistan are just, quote, air raiding villages and killing civilians. I hope Americans know that is not what our brave men and women in uniform are doing in Afghanistan. The U.S. military is fighting terrorism and protecting us and protecting our freedoms.
Peter, does Sarah Palin have a point here, or are military commanders also concerned about the rise in civilian casualties at the hands of coalition troops?
Well, this has been part of the issue of troop levels in Afghanistan, because what has happened repeatedly, and you hear this from military commanders, and part of the reason they're very concerned, is when you don't have adequate troop levels, the way you respond to insurgent violence is through airstrikes, because you don't have enough troops on the ground. And the fact of the matter is, we've had a number of incidents, including one that just was investigated by the U.S. military itself, where dozens of Afghan civilians have been killed. There's a new study, report that came out last week about an incident in eastern Afghanistan. The military originally said that with 6 civilians were killed, and now revealed there were 33. So Obama has been critical of that, but frankly, so have American commanders been critical of that. And frankly, you know, Secretary Gates was in Afghanistan just last month and apologized to the Afghan government for these incidents of civilian casualties. The fact of the matter is that when you don't have adequate ground forces, you're forced to rely on, you know, fire from distance. And when you fire from distance, you're less accurate. A lot of the insurgents look and mingle amongst the civilian populations, so it's hard to get the intelligence on who's who. So the civilian casualties have really skyrocketed over the last year, and it's caused a real problem for the Karzai government and caused real tensions between the U.S. and Afghan governments.
Peter, I want to bring in Robert Kaplan now into the conversation. He's, of course, the correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, a regular visitor to the Middle East and Central Asia. His new book is just out in paperback. It's called Hog Pilots, Blue Water Grunts. Robert Kaplan is in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Robert Kaplan, I want to go back to some of these issues that Peter and I have been discussing, but first I wanted to ask you about the stated goal of the U.S. and NATO-led mission in Afghanistan. Essentially, it's to restore stability to the country and to sort of create a robust and democratic central government. Is that a realistic goal at this point?
If you look back at Afghan history, the high watermark of central government in Afghanistan in recent times was probably King Zahir Shah in the 1950s and 1960s, when the central government controlled the major cities, the ring road around it, and a substantial amount of villages, etc. But it was no means the kind of robust central government that we associate with central government in the West, or even in Iran or Pakistan in the 1950s and 1960s. So compared to other countries, Afghanistan always had a rather weak central government. So that gets to the point of how do you define success in Afghanistan? On what I would define it, on some future morrow, is a kind of benign central government that has more or less control over substantial but not all areas of the country. Because Afghanistan has always been a place with tremendous rural village control, and I'll give you an example. People forget that the original Mujahideen rebellion against the Soviets did not begin in Christmas 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. It began a year and a half earlier when the central government in Kabul tried to extend its writ into many of these villages. That's what ignited the Mujahideen rebellion, which was already ongoing when the Soviets invaded. So my point is that this is a country that has had a long tradition of relatively weak central government, where the central government has had a really, really tough time extending its writ, even during good circumstances. And as we know, these are not good circumstances now.
And Bob Kaplan, as we've been hearing from Peter Spiegel, there is this major review underway at the Pentagon and at the White House over how to reapproach Afghanistan, how to sort of create a new kind of strategy. In a recent op-ed that you wrote for the New York Times, you argued that the basic problem is that the U.S. and NATO approach is too one-dimensional. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah. In other words, it's, you know, when you really strip Afghanistan down to basics, there's a fear, especially among responsible Pakistanis that I've spoken to, that the U.S. government is just engaged in a manhunt. You know, it's hunting for top-level al-Qaeda figures, and that's what it really, really cares about. And if, by any chance, we got really lucky and captured or killed bin Laden, Zawahiri, a few others, there might not be much public support for nation building in Afghanistan after that. Mm-hmm. Regardless of what we say, how committed we are, you know, what about our subconscious feelings? How much are we really, really committed? And this is what really worries the Pakistanis, who see a burgeoning U.S. strategic partnership with India. While we're engaged in what we call nation building, but which deep down in our psychological selves is about a manhunt in Afghanistan, and the Pakistanis feel squeezed and about to be deserted, which is one of the reasons why they have not been nearly as helpful as they could be, mm-hmm. because they have their own interests in Afghanistan, which are very different than ours. It has to do with checking India, just as Lebanon has served as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Afghanistan has been a kind of proxy war between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So unless we, embrace a real regional strategy with shuttle diplomacy between Delhi and Islamabad, in my opinion, in other words, bring India into the equation, we're not going to get the kind of help from the Pakistanis, at least, that we need to get.
I want to ask Peter Spiegel for his take on that theory. Peter Spiegel, if bin Laden and high-level al-Qaeda operatives are captured, would the U.S. military cut and run, or are they in Afghanistan for the long haul?
I mean, if you ask them, they say they're there for the long haul. But I got to say, the people at both at Central Command in Tampa, which is the headquarters that deals with Pakistan, and at the Pentagon say the same thing that Robert's saying. Every time they go to Pakistan, they hear the same thing. They don't trust us. They don't believe we're going to be there for the long term. They feel that we're going to cut and run like we did, you know, in Afghanistan after the Soviet experience. There's incredible paranoia about the U.S. just getting out of there. What Mullen has been discussing in internal meetings, I've been told,
is Admiral Michael Mullen,
again the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is pushing for longer term engagement, particularly for weapons sales. I mean, there's been a big controversy on Capitol Hill over sales of F-16 fighter planes to Pakistan. Mullen has said, let's sell it to them. Let's do a multi-year contract. Let's prove to them we are there for the long term. He is also very sensitive about the India question, trying to get the Indians to, A, tone down their rhetoric, but, B, stop their meddling in other places like in Afghanistan, because they realize, as Secretary Gates has put it, that the Pakistanis basically have a conventional threat to their east and an unconventional threat to their west, and trying to prepare a military to fight both threats is virtually undoable. So they have to make sure that the threat to the east, that the Indian threat, is lowered so they can get the Pakistanis to focus on what they believe is the real threat, which is the insurgency on the west amongst extremists.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of callers on the line here. I want to go to Rich, who's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I served in Afghanistan in 2004 with the 24th MEU, and I just like to say the Afghans welcomed us with open arms. Every village we went to, everybody we met loved us and wanted us there. And where we served was in Kandahar in Tarankal, down near the Pakistani border in the southern Afghanistan. What I want Americans to realize is you got to realize the people we're dealing with here. It's not a political ideology; it's a religious ideology. And it's not like Vietnam where it's just going to go away. And, you know, in 20 years later, we can go there and have normal relations. These religious people, the way we would go into villages, and I tell the story once, we would register voters in 2004, if you remember that, with the elections. And we registered voters in these small towns, and then the next day, the Taliban would stop the vans and ask who had voter registration cards and would shoot them. You know how many people would register to vote in those little towns after that? Zero. And that's the people we're dealing with. And, if they would kill me, you, any of us, our kids, if they could, and leaving is just going to, make the problem worse.
Mm-hmm. Peter Spiegel, Rich's point here that his unit, his Marine Expeditionary Unit, would go in, register voters, and the next day the Taliban would come in. Is that the job for the U.S. military, or is there a greater need for civilians and others in Afghanistan?
Well, this is exactly when we're talking about why Afghanistan is not Iraq, because this is exactly the problem. We're talking about the 24th MEU, even more recently, was in southern Helmand province. The literacy rates in some of these outlying Afghan provinces is 2-3%. The resources they have are minimal. The thinking in Iraq is if once you can get the violence down, it's a society that does have an educated population where the civilian elements can step in and take over these things we're talking about, the elections, the providing of services. In Afghanistan, there is none of that. The literacy rates are so low that there's no one else to step in. There's no civilians who can step in to do those kinds of things. And the only people who are able to do it right now is the military. And that's a real problem. Until the Afghans can establish their own civilian organizations to do these some kind of functions, the international military is going to have to take care of it, and that's why people see a really, really long, hard slog in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm.
Peter Spiegel is the LA Times correspondent at the Pentagon. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Guy.
Robert Kaplan, please stand by.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you about this overall sense that there are not enough troops in Afghanistan. What is your sense about it? I mean, is that the answer, essentially, in Afghanistan at the moment?
Well, first, just let me go back to one thing about what Admiral Mullen has been saying about India and everything, just for a second here. Because India and Pakistan have fought over Afghanistan for decades, a responsible policy from the point of view of an Afghan leader should be to be neutral between India and Pakistan. President Karzai has not been that. He's been the most provocatively pro-Indian leader in Afghanistan in a long time. He's allowed the Indians to open consulates all around the country near the border area with Pakistan. So this has really been enraging the Pakistanis. And that's why, again, we need to work with President Karzai, with Delhi, with Islamabad for a real regional strategy in terms of the number of troops. Afghanistan, in a way, is more sprawling than Iraq. Its population is more diffused. It's even though it has, I think the population is 25 million, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. something like that. It's a it's one of the few countries in the third world that has not really heavily urbanized. It's still predominantly a rural population, which means you have people just spread out all over the place, not concentrated in population nodes, and which means more troops will not necessarily solve the problem. They'll just get lost in the immensity of the geography there. It's whereas, as Peter said, whereas Iraq is very flat with high population nodes, Afghanistan is very diverse with riven by mountains and deep cut valleys. Troops are not going to solve the problem, but that doesn't mean more troops can't help. But they'll have to be they will have to be used differently than they have been, because what we have in Afghanistan, what we've had is a lot of NATO troops on major bases, just holed up in the bases, not really having all the effect that they could have outside. Yeah. So there is some similarity with Iraq, about getting troops outside of the bases, into the villages, into the towns with the ANA, the Afghan National Army, to embed with the Afghan National Army. But that alone is not going to be enough. What we're going to need is a lot more civilian help, civilian NGO expertise.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call now. Michael is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air with Robert Kaplan.
Hi, I have 2 points. One, the history of Afghanistan is very important, but long before Zaire Shah. Namely, the British got their clock cleaned 3 times there, and the Russians had I don't know how many 100,000 troops, and they got thrown out. Secondly, American military methods will not work there. Our current doctrine is to bomb and conduct maneuvers with live ammunition. The whole world knows that we won't take casualties. So there's no way that we can win in Afghanistan. Michael Hoyer has already said we've lost.
Michael Scheuer, right?
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm.
Robert Kaplan, caller Michael, is saying that Afghanistan is lost. Do you think it's still salvageable?
Yes, I think it's still salvageable, but it's going to be a long-term operation. We're going to end up being in Afghanistan, I think, longer than we were in Vietnam. If you use the measure of the Vietnam War from the early 1960s to to 1975, that's like 13 years, 15 years. We've already been in Afghanistan 7 years. With no end in sight. And I think we will slog it out with NATO allies, because it's not just about Afghanistan. If we desert Afghanistan, we also, in a sense, doom Pakistan to its fate. And that does India no favors. So, it's a region we're talking about. But the way to do this is not to, American troops alone are not going to do this. If we can't get help from NATO allies, from Pakistani allies, from India, et cetera, I fear that your caller may be telling the truth.
So a lot of that depends on that regional cooperation.
Yeah. This is really about leveraging regional cooperation.
But at the same time, Robert Kaplan, many calls, appeals to NATO, including one recently this past weekend by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in Budapest, have gone unanswered, with some exceptions, of course. France is sending some additional troops. But by and large, more than half of the force in Afghanistan is American.
Yes, I know that. This gets to the whole question of many NATO countries have troops, they have militaries, but they don't want to take any casualties because their publics cannot support it. But there's a lot that can be done in peaceful parts of Afghanistan, in relatively peaceful parts of Afghanistan like the north, that are not necessarily risky, and where NATO troops, even if they're averse to taking casualties, can still make a contribution.
Robert Kaplan, hold that thought and stand by. We're discussing the future of Afghanistan. Joining me from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, is Robert Kaplan, correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Also joining us now from Paris is Jeremy Shapiro. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Brookings Afghanistan Index, a wonderful resource that you can find online. That resource tracks the country's progress in incredible detail. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, Jeremy, are more troops the answer to resolving the crisis in Afghanistan, in your view?
No, in my view, they're certainly not the answer. I think, as a couple of your guests have pointed out, they can help in specific local situations. But when we look at what the problems are in Afghanistan, many of them have been alluded to: corruption, governance, the problem of Pakistan and infiltration from Pakistan, and the problem of international civilian coordination and getting international civilian capacity onto the ground in Afghanistan. It's hard to see exactly how additional troops really help that situation. Clearly, you need to create some security space, and troops can do that in specific local situations. But in a country the size of Afghanistan, you're not going to pacify the country with the levels of troops that we would even imagine. And I would say, moreover, you're not going to reduce civilian casualties by adding troops.
Mm-hmm. So flooding the zone is not, in your view, the solution for the moment. I want to take a call now. Ambassador Swanee Hunt is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy. And there's been a lot of wisdom expressed on this program thus far, and I'm glad I can add a hopeful dimension here. I've worked with hundreds of Afghan women leaders for a decade, including bringing them to speak at the European Parliament and NATO, et cetera. And I have found that your speaker earlier, who talked about this being a religious ideology, is only partly right. It's also very much a cultural one. In Afghanistan, like in conflicts all over the world, there is a host of untapped resources, and that is the women. They now are 27% of the parliament. And worldwide, we know that the higher the percentage of women, the lower the corruption. So we have an opportunity here to elevate women leaders in every part of the society, and that de facto reduces the power of the extremists.
Interesting idea. Robert Kaplan, correspondent with The Atlantic Monthly. What do you make of Ambassador Hunt's argument here?
I think that one of the challenges is going to be that, you know, in my experience in Afghanistan, is that in the cities, you find, much more freedom and liberation for the women. But you get into some of these villages, and as the ambassador alluded, that's really where the progress needs to be made. And the oppression of women in Afghanistan is more than just religious. It's also tribal. That goes back to pre-Islamic times with Pukhtunwali, the code of the Pashtuns. So we're really dealing with very inchoate, deep set, cultural issues here. Of course, it's true that, you know, the more women you have in the bureaucracy, probably the less corruption you would have. The problem is, how do you do that? One of the issues that we haven't really, that we've skirted around is, you know, there's like a conundrum here. On the one hand, you want to get more NGOs and others into these villages, but on the other hand, NGOs will not go to places when there's not security.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, one thing about Iraq is first we improved the security, and then some other things started to go online, though the situation in Iraq is still very, very tenuous. But, you know, the real issue is how do we secure the countryside or more of it? And now I'm going to say something that's probably very controversial, because flooding the zone is impossible with the kind of troop numbers that we'd need and don't have. You know, at some point, we are going to have to make some kind of political compromise with some Taliban elements. The Taliban is not monochrome. It is not uniform. There are different, you know, they don't necessarily have a world view in the way that Al-Qaeda has a world view. And we're going to have to try to split them up, you know, work with some Taliban elements, bring some Taliban elements into the government as part of a coalition. That is the only political solution that I see.
Ambassador Swanee Hunt, if you're still with us, what about this idea that Robert Kaplan talks about, even negotiating with the Taliban?
Well, it's so interesting to hear the discussion about village to compared to the cities, because there is women's leadership in the villages if, as he said, you can provide the security. And I think that we do have to break down the Taliban and understand that these are young men who were raised without families and, you know, given a sort of massive indoctrination. And if we can find people who among that group whom we can work with, we know that in any war, in any culture, there are times when people who are more toward the middle can move over. So I don't dispute that, but we are not doing nearly what we can do at a village level with our policies. Like, we've allowed the Supreme Court to have no women on it, and it's the Supreme Court that has allowed some of the most atrocious tribal village customs against women.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Swanee Hunt, thanks so much for calling in. I want to go now to Jeremy Shapiro with the Brookings Institution and ask you, Jeremy, about this idea of negotiating with the Taliban. In a sense, would that be compromising the principles by which the United States sort of has operated in Afghanistan, or is it essentially come down to this idea that there is no other alternative at this point? You've got to negotiate with some elements within the Taliban.
Well, first you'd have to define what those principles are. It's not my understanding of what the United States and the international community is doing in Afghanistan that it's trying to remake the society or to fix every injustice. What we're trying to do, as I understand it, is create a reasonably stable place that won't serve as a basis for attacking us and for destabilizing the region. And consistent with that principle, then it seems to me that if you can find people who are willing to reconcile to those basic principles, and I think there's a great deal of the Taliban is sort of an expression more than a fact, that are more than willing to do that kind of thing. They have to accept the constitutional settlement. I think we have to be very careful with what we try to do to Afghanistan. I'm not thrilled with the decisions of the Afghanistan Supreme Court, but the notion that it is us that should decide who is on the Afghan Supreme Court, and the notion that it is us that should decide what is appropriate for that society in ways that have very little to do with our security, I think is a trap to that would bring even more elements of Afghan society against us and would lengthen our commitment there.
Mm-hmm. Robert Kaplan?
Yeah, I agree with that. I completely agree with that. We're not remaking the society. What we're trying to do is get a modicum of civil order, of predictable civil order, of a reasonable amount on both sides of the border in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and a government in Kabul that all elements of which we may not agree with, but which overall we can work with. And we can keep it as a space where a group like Al Qaeda cannot just have a comfortable base of operations and plan attacks on the outside world. In other words, that's a much more minimal standard than remaking the society. So I agree with Jeremy on that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when it comes to Afghanistan is we tend to forget the NATO equation here. Obviously, NATO forces about half of the total force presence in Afghanistan, about 35,000. Some countries operate in Afghanistan with so-called caveats. They can't engage in offensive operations, but other countries do. I want to get a caller in on this issue. Helen is on the line from Edinburgh, Virginia. Helen, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. I am originally Canadian. I'm an American now, but I never hear about the contribution that my homeland, my native country, has made in this war, and I understand they have had a lot of casualties. they have taken part in combat. They've got about 2,000 men serving there, and I believe they've had almost 100 killed. So I would just like to hear more from the American press about the contributions that my native country are making instead of treating it like a potted palm.
Robert Kaplan.
Frustrating. Mm-hmm.
Helen, thanks for the call. Robert Kaplan, an interesting point. Earlier, you may recall this year, Secretary Robert Gates actually in an interview with Peter Spiegel from the LA Times, who we had on earlier, mentioned that seemed to suggest that NATO countries didn't know how to do counterinsurgency, as he said. He eventually backtracked on that, but caused a lot of tension among NATO allies. NATO has made a significant contribution to the Afghan conflict.
Yeah, let me just say that my brother-in-law is Canadian, and he's served on one tour in Afghanistan. He's going to serve on another tour. And I think on a per capita basis, the Canadians may have suffered as many or more casualties than the Americans on a per capita basis.
More.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, they're making a real contribution, and they're one of the countries that are actually fighting and taking casualties. There are other countries, I think, that the Italians and the Germans, which are not, which are basically deployed in places which are fairly peaceful in the north. I think what Secretary Gates was getting at is that, look, whatever you think of the Iraq War, it has really hardened and improved the quality, not the manpower, but the quality of the American fighting force, in the sense that the American fighting force has had a very steep learning curve in counterinsurgency in Iraq, to a degree where the United States Army in particular, Marine Corps in particular, are really ahead of other countries because they've actually had to suffer, be deployed, and actually fight and learn on the ground counterinsurgency and apply principles from the British in Malaysia and other places throughout the 20th century. So that there's just a fact that we're further ahead on this.
I want to get another call before we have to
on that just a little bit.
Go ahead, Jeremy Shapiro from Brookings.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what Robert said. The problem, I think, for a lot of these other militaries who are making a really important contribution, and many of which are fighting very bravely, is not exactly that they aren't so far along in counterinsurgency, at least as militaries, but it's rather that they don't have the sort of backups in terms of integration with the civil side that the U.S. has. And so what happens is that in Afghanistan, the Canadians can clear a valley, just like the Americans can clear a valley, but then they aren't able to follow in on that with civilian projects and liaison with the Afghan government and liaison with the rest of the international community in the way that the Americans have developed over the past few years. And that's been something that is very difficult for them to do and very difficult for them to get a handle on.
Sunder is on the line from Aiken, South Carolina. Sunder, welcome to the program.
Yes, I was born in that area, Waziristan, and the capital is Miran Shah now.
You were born in Waziristan?
That's correct, sir. Mm-hmm. The capital city, Miran Shah, a village 4 miles, 2-3 miles away from that one. And I am more familiar with this people. The thing which I am going to introduce here, that nobody has, I listen to all these things. You got to introduce this thing, how to get rid of those false ideology by which they are forced or persuaded to practice. And that's why then they are misguided and they follow that because they think that ideology, like if you die for the name of religion and everything is there, you see, it's everything for them and for their ancestors also.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is taken into consideration, you cannot improve them.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy Shapiro from Brookings Institution. Sundar is talking about what he calls the false ideology that has to be sort of a cancer that has to be removed from Afghan society. He's originally from Miran Shah in Waziristan. What do you make of his comments? Jeremy Shapiro? I think we've lost Jeremy Shapiro. Robert Kaplan, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm still with you.
Yeah. What do you make of Sunder's comments?
The false ideologies that he's referred to, I've been to Waziristan, and Waziristan, you know, viewers should know, is part of the, part of the tribal agencies of Pakistan, part of the federally administered tribal areas, the whole northwest frontier area. This is a part of Pakistan that that Pakistani governments have done very little comparatively in the way of building roads, building schools, digging water wells, developing the place. So it's a very backward area where women's literacy is extremely infinitesimally low. And in this kind of area which is heavily tribalized, which is underdeveloped, where there's very little education, false ideologies take hold. Or I wouldn't say false, I would just say, to our minds, extremist ideologies mm-hmm. take hold. And but we're not going to solve things at the ideological level. We're not going to win an argument against people in villages. You know, all that we can do is get representative government in a few basic nodes that, you know, where these tribal leaders can feel that they are bought into, that they can have a say in, that they have influence over, so that in order to pacify the area.
Robert Kaplan, in the remaining few seconds we have, General David Petraeus, soon to become the overall commander for Central Command, the region that includes Afghanistan. Will that have an impact?
Yes, I think it will. He's an extremely intellectually adroit, quick study. I've met him and, spoken to him at length on several occasions. He's a real problem solver. He will have a definite impact. You know, he is, remember, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is not really in the chain of command. General mm-hmm. Petraeus will speak directly to the new mm-hmm. president as the combatant mm-hmm. commander of Central Command.
Robert Kaplan, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Guy Raz, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.